talk about opening lines, Nick Hornby's latest novel, Juliet Naked, begins this way. They had flown from England to Minneapolis to look at a toilet. What follows is the stories of Tucker Crowe, an American singer who produced one brilliant album in the mid-80s and then disappeared, Duncan, the leader of the singer's small but rabid fan club, and Annie, Duncan's long-suffering partner, who's been dragged 3,000 miles to see a toilet in a rock club where something may have happened to Tucker, in fact, and turned around his life. It's a novel of obsession, music, love, loneliness, parenting, regret, and redemption, published by Riverhead Books, and it brings Nick Hornby, the author of the bestsellers High Fidelity, Fever Pitch, and About a Boy, back to our show today. Hi, Nick. It's good to see you again.
Good to see you, too.
Rock music snobs have been has been one of your themes. Do you know many of them?
I do know a few. I've spent an awful lot of time with them, I guess, over the last 20 or 30 years, and I probably was one myself at some point in my life.
In this novel, it's about the kind of pop cultural obsessives who devote themselves to the study of someone somebody else's career and declare themselves world experts on the subject. But they usually focus on the famous stars, Bob Dylan, John Lennon, Bruce Springsteen. Are there many people obsessing over one album wonders like Tucker Crowe?
I think there are people obsessing over everybody, actually. If you look on the internet, you'll find any writer, any musician, anyone at all with a website devoted to them.
And why do you think, what's the reason behind this kind of crazy obsessiveness? Do people like Duncan live vicariously through their favorite rock stars? Do they wind up somehow becoming them in their own minds?
I'm not sure it's that. I think that the obscurity has an awful lot to recommend it in the case of these people, that knowing something about somebody that no one else knows anything about is indeed part of the attraction.
When you reviewed rock music, were you able to separate the critic from the fan in yourself?
I don't think it's necessarily very helpful, in a way, to do that. Critics are critics because they're fans. And, of course, you have to try and find some kind of objective voice in which to write. But it comes from pretty much the same place, I think, the same sense of disappointment and pleasure.
I read the obituary the other day of one of the Charles Manson women who just died, and I was reminded that one of the reasons that they engaged in those killings was that they were reading all sorts of messages into the Beatles' White Album.
Oh, yes, Helter Skelter, most famously. And I think there are certain artists who appear to be opaque, even if they're not necessarily opaque, but they appear to be opaque to fans. I was thinking about the difference between Dylan and, say, Springsteen, where Springsteen's message seems fairly clear, I think, in the music and doesn't need decoding in the same way.
And that's why there isn't a Springsteenologist as there was a Dylanologist. I remember A.J. Weberman, who used to go through Bob Dylan's garbage trying to find out the secret messages.
Yeah, no matter what Dylan does, he cannot convince people that he's not opaque. If he runs a radio show, people want to try and decode that. If he sells a song to to lingerie company, people think there's a hidden message in there somewhere. It's interesting.
Well, one of the good things about CDs is you can't play them backwards, unlike what people did with old Beatles records.
I bet someone's found a way somewhere.
Tucker Crowe's, your character's fans, call themselves Crowologists. So are they looking for secret messages? What is it about what he did that would lead them to do that sort of thing?
Well, I think there were two things. He's got a perfect storm going in terms of obsessive fans. One is that he made an album about a relationship breaking up. So all that old debate about authenticity in art, he kind of belongs in that camp that everyone listens to this album and hears the sound of searing heartbreak. And that always helps. And the second thing he did was disappear. And, of course, the moment you disappear, you make yourself deep as a human being.
And then, of course, you deal with the whole matter of the authenticity, which perhaps isn't as authentic as the fans would like to believe.
It's maybe not as authentic as the fans would like to believe, but I suspect if we could ever hear this record, we'd be fooled too.
Now, you actually come up with song titles. Were you composing an album in your head while you were doing this? Was that necessary? I mean, did you have a sense of what his music might have been like?
Yes, I did. I did have a sense of that. One thing that actually threw me a little bit was the 80s, because when I listen to the 80s or think about the 80s, all I can hear is that horrible syndrome sound and synthesizers all over the place. It wasn't a great time for authenticity, so I had to plonk my authentic man in the middle of this decade.
But one of the things that you're dealing with here is how an artist sees the music and how the fans react to the music, and it isn't always the same thing.
It isn't always the same thing, and I think that one thing that my own career has taught me is it's not always the same thing. And
I mean, does this happen with books as well? Because I know I've spoken to authors who've told me that they've met fans who've read all sorts of stuff into their books that they not only didn't intend, but are kind of horrified to hear about.
Yes. I think it's happened to me a couple of times where people's interpretations of something that seemed perfectly straightforward to me was a long way off what I intended. But you have to let people have their connections with things.
Why would Annie, who seems to be a fairly reasonable person, tolerate Duncan's obsession with this disappeared rock star?
Well, partly this is a book about geography, that Annie and Duncan live in a really sleepy and not very attractive seaside town through reasons of work, and they kind of huddled together for warmth some time ago, the warmth provided by a mutual interest in reading and music and all sorts of things. And there aren't too many people in this town like that. So she's really made the best of a very bad job, and the novel is set around the time when this relationship starts to fracture.
But she allows herself to be schlepped all the way from northern England to Minneapolis. Minneapolis, which of course is a kind of a legendary American rock city. Prince comes from
Absolutely.
Minneapolis.
There are so many American cities that have occupied large parts of the imagination of English rock fans. I think if you live in the north of England, you cannot imagine how exotic most of North America seems, pretty much anywhere in North America.
Have you ever wondered about why the same thing applies in the opposite direction? There are many Americans who are obsessed by English rock stars. And I just saw Hair the other day, and one of the scenes involves a guy being given a Mick Jagger poster, and it's the nicest thing anybody could have done.
Yes. Well, I mean, of course there's the exoticism of distance for both of us. I think that that the role that English musicians played in the 1960s was to possibly elevate rock music to a more ambitious place. I guess that's what the Beatles and the Stones did, was made it in some ways more pretentious.
Well, let's not go all the way. Herman's Hermits, I don't think, have too many obsessives following them.
No, I'm not sure they raised music to a higher plane either. But
Nick Hornby's latest novel is called Juliet Naked, and it's published by Riverhead Books. Many of your characters use music to relate to other people, but also to judge them. And I think this is something that happens with books as well. Somebody will come to your home and look at your book collection, and you know that you're either coming out of it looking okay or looking like an idiot in their eyes.
It's going to be interesting in the future if e-readers really take off, and obviously we all have music stored in these tiny little white cigarette boxes as well, that if we're not displaying our taste in our home, I think it will make some of us feel quite insecure.
How well do you think that Duncan would get along with Dick, the music nerd clerk from High Fidelity?
I think Duncan would feel very superior. I conceived Duncan as a kind of scholar Monquet, that if he'd obsessed about Gerard Manley Hopkins or Jane Austen or Marla, he would be gainfully employed in an English institution talking about them all day. But of course, he can't do that.
Well, we have this whole thing with rock music becoming more than just popular music, and we even see it in Tucker, who says that his influences are Dylan Thomas, Harold Pinter, Johnny Cash, Albert Camus, and early Dolly Parton.
I think that's Duncan, actually, who's citing. Yes, yeah. So I'm not sure Tucker would say that about himself, but Duncan sees all this in the music.
Well, the protagonist of Juliet Naked are slightly older than the characters of your earlier books. On one level, they're struggling with the sort of things that all adults have to struggle with, parent-child relationships, for example, and yet they can't get past their adolescent obsessions. And I always think about this. In the past, teenagers would love pop music of their time, and then they would move on to something less youth-oriented, Sinatra, Tony Bennett, maybe jazz, classical music, maybe a combination of all. Now many of them just continue to listen to the same music that they listened to when they were younger.
Well, I think...
And it's not just nostalgia. It's something else.
It's not nostalgia. And partly we have the example of artists growing old in front of our eyes. We were talking about Dylan earlier on. Well, you know, here is a man who is no spring chicken anymore, but is, over the last few years, has made some music that is of value about growing old, I think. Neil Young's done the same thing. Springsteen's done the same thing. I don't think it is an adolescent obsession anymore. And you can see some bands and musicians who clearly won't, I think, be able to bridge that gap, but plenty of others will, and it's an idiom that's survived, I think unexpectedly so.
In this case, we have this musician who kind of dropped out. Now, why would he have dropped out after he'd had a hit record? Part of this story also involves a new release based on the it's called, I guess, Juliet Naked, because it doesn't have all of, it's the demo records. It doesn't have all the fancy instrumentation that the original release had.
Well, Tucker partly dropped out without giving too much of the story away because he felt that he pretty much said all he had to say in this one album, and he, I think, was worried about how he was going to follow it up, and as we hinted at before, he was troubled by the authenticity of this particular album.
The breakup is with a woman who he realizes he didn't care all that much about anyway.
Exactly. And, you know, that was something that was prompted by all the songs that we hear all the time, where I found myself thinking, I wonder, you know, did he really care about this woman, this song that we're listening to 30 or 40 years later? Or was it a one-night stand? Was he out of his head at the time that he met her? There are all sorts of issues of authenticity and things like that.
Now, Bob Dylan was reported to have said that nothing good has been written the past 20 years in pop music. Would you go along with that?
No. I think there's been...
Is he just protecting his own, defending his own turf?
Well, Dylan seems to be going further and further back into the past, you know, with each year, that he's gone way beyond his own childhood even. He's further back than that. And I think that there is a kind of authenticity that he prizes that he isn't going to find anymore now. But I think there are plenty of good bands around.
Now, you not only write novels, you have done a fair number of film scripts. You're working on, or have you already finished, the script for An Education?
An Education comes out next week.
It better be finished.
I'm just doing the last touches now, yeah. No, it opens on, I think, October the 9th and premieres next week.
How does it compare working on somebody else's text, somebody else's ideas, as opposed to stuff that's just coming out of your own imagination?
Well, I worked on a piece that was originally 10 pages long, and I turned this into a 120-page screenplay. So for me, this was the ideal combination, that I was given a suggestion, as it were, of characters and a narrative arc, and I could flesh it out how I wanted.
A number of your books have been made into films as well. And I wonder if you're ever surprised. A character, when you were writing the character, you probably imagined the person looking a certain way and talking a certain way and even delivering a line that you wrote in a certain way. And then suddenly it's quite different.
Well, I think the big difference is that when I'm writing books, I never imagine people to look like John Cusack or Hugh Grant or Colin Firth. They tend to be, I think, in my own head, more ordinary than that. But, of course, that's the difference between movies and life. No ordinary-looking person can make a living in the movie world.
Although it's always good to have your movie, your book adapted to a movie, because you make a lot of money. On the other hand, any number of authors have been upset by what came out. You know, it has nothing to do with what they had written, except maybe the title and a couple of characters' names.
Yeah, I'm always amazed that writers have the gall to complain, actually. You know, it's like selling anything. It's not yours anymore. That's why they gave you the money. So I don't think it's appropriate to complain.
Oh, well, especially since you're doing the same thing to other writers when you're doing an adaptation of their work. So what are you working on now? Are you working on another novel? Or are you doing
I haven't
more
started a novel. My current project is I'm halfway through a, well, I guess it's an album, with the musician Ben Folds. I've been sending him words and he's been turning them into songs. And we're, I guess, two-thirds of the way through that.
Now, he's a songwriter who writes some pretty good words on his own.
Yes.
So does it become a collaboration, or does he just simply give himself up to your words?
I think that's part of the exercise for him, that he's not messing around with my words. He's just seeing what he can do, and partly that's the structure I'm imposing on him.
But this is collaboration, and this is and when you're writing a novel, of course, there's no collaboration. You sit alone. But when you're working on films and doing other things of this sort, it's always a collaboration.
Yeah.
And songwriters will tell you they never know who did what half the time.
Oh, I know who did what in this case. And it makes you realize that actually the music's pretty much always more important than the words in terms of a great song. But it's something I've learned about the last few years, is I do want to collaborate as much as possible where I can. Obviously, I can't with the books, but there are other areas, and I'm not altogether a fan of sitting on my own in a room all day.
Nick Hornby will be reading and signing books tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the Union Square Barnes & Noble store. His new novel, Juliet Naked, is published by Riverhead. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Pleasure.